Welcome to Crane Radio. Celebrate a life well lived.
Welcome to this first season of The Modern Crone, the 21st Century Shaman. I have invited the most powerful, eclectic and woke shamanic folk I know to talk with me about their take on shamanism and tap you straight into the minds and hearts of those who are the real deal 21st century shamans. Real people, real stories and a whole lot of mind-blowing, spirit-stirring juju. For the past 50 years, Maggie Wisson has been an explorer, a student, and a practitioner within the field of esoteric science. She has worked independently and in collaboration with others, bringing the esoteric sciences to the worlds of healing, writing, publishing, personal and spiritual development programs, and workshops. Maggie has been influenced by a range of traditions, philosophies, and theories, and respectfully acknowledges their contribution in forging her own pathway and what she refers to as the world work. She is the co-creator and co-facilitator of the Human Odyssey, a map for the journey, and she has a strong alliance and involvement with the Earth Treasure Vase Global Healing Project. Her own body of work is held as Opus Sonus, a work existing on subtle levels and the inner planes, and that is now emerging and being given further expression in the outer world to serve the evolutionary imperatives of our time. Maggie Wisson, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to our first season of The Modern Crone, the 21st Century Shaman. How are you?
Good. Thank you very much, darling. Lovely to be here.
Fantastic. So, Maggie, I reckon we jump just straight into the theme for this season. So when I first contacted you to ask you if you'd like to speak with me on The Modern Crone, and when I told you that the first season was called The 21st Century Shaman, your immediate response was, oh, I don't identify myself as being shaman or with shamanism. Yet when I engage with the work that you do, where you write beautifully around the dynamics of spirit, the song lines in the land, Australian shamanic lore, I absolutely associate you with shamanism. So could you describe for me what your view of shamanism is?
Thank you, Dani. Well, it certainly evolved from that moment. Yes, it was quite an abrupt. I'm not a shaman and I don't do podcasts, I think, very initial response. So that led me then to question what my notion of shamanism was. So the first port of call, of course, is that source of all knowledge called Google.
Yeah.
I popped that into Google and got a few headers from what people were describing as shamanism. And then I started to place my own story within that, which has become quite revealing as we've entered in. The first one that I drew out as a headline was Travelling Between Worlds to Bring Back Information. Oh, prior to that, I guess the concept that I realised I had of shamanism was the vision of the old shaman in the middle of the African village, around the fire with his group, going into trance, yeah, bringing back what he did. And I realised I was stuck there still. So Travelling Between Worlds to Bring Back Information, for me, that sort of began early in my 20s with a level of channeling, of mediumship. My teacher then and my partner of those years, Joan Carter, we worked both individually as a pair, but we also worked in developmental groups with others as well. So channeling through all sorts of levels of beings. That then, another one of the headings was a link between worlds, out of body and mystical experiences. So in that period of time, I did a lot of what was then known as rescue work.
Yep.
Which was people who'd passed over but had not fully made the transition, usually held by a point of trauma, unresolved issues. So they were stuck between worlds, if you like. And for whatever reason, I seemed to be a lighthouse that just drew them in. So the work, doing it with Joan, I would, the being would come into me. I would be there with Joan. She would link with the person, get the story, a level of counselling, if you like, speaking to the being, saying it was time to move on. And then I would literally walk them up through the levels.
Okay.
Through proverbially is that tunnel of light, until I could find the being on the other side that was there waiting for them.
Beautiful.
And then they would move on. That for me, it was very demanding. It actually took over my life. For some reason, the door was just so wide open. It took a lot before I could get a very deep, profound level of no.
Yeah.
I think probably karmically it was just time. I'd done my duty, so to speak. But what it gave me, Dani, which I'm enormously grateful for, is this... it galvanized my relationship to spirit, because as I moved through those levels, let's call it that tunnel of light, I received the blessing. I was in, as people describe, this sense of deep peace, of beauty, very profound. And that really has been a continuous platform from which the rest of my life could take ground and hold.
And the spiritual journey is like that, isn't it? And I know we're still going through the checkpoints of defining shamanism, but just on that point, with the benefit of retrospect, you could look back at different junctures of your journey and see that it was all in divine order, can't you? That you were being prepared, you were ripening, you were very much being held. And I also think it's really interesting. So I didn't realise that you had a past working in mediumship, and then that then led you into much more land-based and shamanic based frameworks, whereas my experience has almost been the flip. So
right.
I started with the land-based shamanic practices and so on, and now in my life mediumship has opened up as an offering. So, and I am going to do a podcast season on mediumship, so I you're on that one too. You're going to be a regular. But Maggie, one of the other really typical references to the shamanic way or the shamanic path is these references of the wounded healer or the shaman's death. This is another one, isn't it? And it's very common in that, from what I can see, in a lot of different shamanic traditions around the world. And it talks about the archetype of a transformation happening in your life through illness or great difficulty. Mm-hmm. And that's been a part of your journey, hasn't it, Maggie? Where you've, could you tell us a bit more about how the journey of your physical body and those kind of physical struggles have led to spiritual transformation for you?
Yes, absolutely. The shaman's death, shaman's illness. From that period of the 20s, 30s, Joan and I moved interstate. We moved straight into the Ash Wednesday bushfires, some very tragic wildfires. Not so long after that, Joan herself died. And shortly after that, my brother also died. So there was quite a lot of work around death, personally and outwardly as well. So I found myself left standing alone, basically. I was interstate, without support networks, etc. But also that previous cycle had completed to some degree. So that sort of set up the existential question of who am I? Where do I go from here? Was this previous work with Joan something that I needed to leave behind, or did I need to pick up the roots? Another one of those shamanistic headlines was feeling like you're outside society.
Yeah.
So I think that one rose its head, and I tried with earnestness to fit myself into normal life in a brackets. So I was simultaneously working a 9-to-5 job, but also setting up the spiritual work, counselling and healing, etc. And it worked well for a while until the worlds split apart, and I fell very deeply into the chasm.
Okay, and how did that express through your body mainly?
It was all my systems collapsed, actually.
Okay.
Neurological, muscular, nervous system. So it was a 14-year process.
Wow.
Where I really was non-existent, you know. But for the love of my beloved partner, Ava, you know, and the enormity of heart, you know, this learning of surrendering on such a profound level. At the beginning of it, I was told that I had to live in the house below the line.
Wow.
And it was so. I had to, for me, I was nothing, no one. And yet through that process, somehow other people still met my being.
Yeah, incredible.
That gets reflected back to you. It's very profound to surrender. So I couldn't walk. I was in a wheelchair. I couldn't go out the door. If I stood at the side of the road, my body would just collapse.
Did you go through like a period of kind of fighting that? Did you go through those real human experiences of anger and why me?
Absolutely.
You kind of have to in a way though, don't you, before you can get to a point of just laying all your weapons down, don't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it got to a point of what I call the last breath. So energetically, you know, chronic fatigue, all sorts of diagnoses that were, but basically energy levels were non-existent.
Yeah.
It was very hard to lift a hand. I couldn't coordinate to work out how to cut a tomato.
Wow.
Everything was, and I was disconnected from spirit, probably necessarily so. And at that point, it was the notion of I have to let go and surrender. Once the battle stopped, once the shame stopped, all of those elements, life will either support me or it won't.
Yep.
If it doesn't, I will leave. That was sort of my resolve. But I needed to let life, I needed to give it a go.
Yep.
Give life an opportunity to prove the point or not.
Nice.
It got to, there was one experience of what I described as getting to my last breath.
Okay.
And there was sort of an arising sense of terror. And somehow, instinctively, I knew to reduce myself to nothing. And at that point, I guess what also kicked in was my own will to live.
Beautiful. Wow. Okay, so that in itself is a podcast. So you've described to me moving through that and then really moving into a healing journey from there. And a really seminal point of that was where you made connection with African land. Mm-hmm. And a whole new field opened up to you, didn't it, in terms of accessing strength from the land and really a new trajectory for your life. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you ended up going to Africa?
Basically, I was lying in bed, awake, and beside me appeared this small African woman who said nothing.
Yeah.
There was deep silence, but within that silence, I knew it was a beckoning and an invitation. And I knew in that moment I needed to go to Africa.
Amazing. So you mobilised. You got your boots?
I got my boots, signed up at the very last gasp minute when it was actually closed, but they let me in.
Excellent.
And off I went to Africa, to the White Lions. I actually ended up going 3 times to the White Lions. And also on one of those journeys had the privilege of being with Credo Mutwa, who was the high shaman called Sanusi of Africa, and also camping out in the bush for the Kalahari Bushmen.
Amazing.
So it was wondrous. But the white lions are star beings.
Yep.
Said they've come from the stars. And they've come here at this particular time to assist humanity in this great period of transformation that we're amidst. There is a lovely story of Linda and how it began. Do you want me to?
Yes, please.
So Linda Tucker, who was born in South Africa but had been in, I think it was London, for many years, working very high profile in the advertising modelling industry. She returned home to South Africa to her family. They were sitting around the campfire drinking their lagers, as you do, and they could hear the lions roaring in the background. And they knew that a baby lion was due to be born.
Mm.
So they hopped in their open-air four-wheel Jeep and off they set out in the darkness to go and see this white lion. Inappropriately, of course, but as we do. When they arrived there, they became surrounded by a pride of angry, protective lions. And as they went to start the Jeep to make retreat, the Jeep wouldn't start.
Okay.
So they sat there terrified, with lions literally breathing upon them in this open-aired Jeep. Then out of the darkness, out of the bush, walked a small African woman. She had a baby on her breast, a grandchild, and a little, not much bigger than toddler, grandson walking behind her. And they just walked through the pride of lions and initiated the rescue of those that were there.
Amazing.
Linda, this was Maria Kosa, who was the lion shaman. Linda Tucker went back to her high-pressured job, etc.
Mm.
Also began her shamanic illness, if you like, began heading towards breakdown.
Mm.
Realised she needed to go back and find Maria Kosa again, which she did. Maria's greeting to her was, "What took you so long?"
Mm.
And this began a life's work for Linda Tucker, who is now the lion shaman. Maria Kosa had prophesied that in the year 2000, there would be a great event. And in the year 2000, on the 25th of December, so Christmas Day, in the town of Bethlehem in South Africa, there was a lion cub born. She was Maria, who is the queen of the lions. White lions, they're not albino, they're a very beautiful, special beings. In South Africa, they've had what's called the canned hunting industry.
Yeah.
So they hold lions in cages and trophy hunters come and shoot them at close range to take a trophy. So white lions were prized. Actually, there was news yesterday that the South African government is going to close down
the industry. Fabulous. So the white lion born in Bethlehem, as prophesied by the lioness shaman, was this a lion born in captivity?
Yes.
Okay.
Kept in a dungeon
for
years. She had two lion cubs who also were kept in the dungeon. They didn't see the light of day. They would breed them until it was time. Linda Tucker, it's a magnificent story if you read the book. She, in the end, rescued Mara and the two cubs and returned them to land called Timbavati, which is the homeland of the white lions. So this was my journey to be with the white lions, and they are remarkable beings. I have written about it in some of the writings
My
own awareness that's there. So
we're linking your writing to this podcast, Maggie, so people can read these stories and so on. But So you felt being in the presence, first of all, absorbing the history and the story and the cosmic relevance of the White Lines, but then also being on the land and working with the shaman who understand the energy and the offering of the White Lines really started then to transform your understanding as well of the shamanic way and also your offering.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there were, for me, Africa has brought many shamanic experiences that, as you said, have come out of the land rather than the more heavenly base that I was used to.
Yeah.
Life transforming, absolutely. Mama Africa is phenomenal. I mean, as soon as you hit a land, it's like our arms are wide open and in you go. Very different to this land.
All lands are very different. That has been a feature of these podcasts, I have to say, is every single person I've spoken with has really talked about the importance of connection with the wild, connection with the land, to be able mm-hmm. to access the love and intelligence that's there. And that's the thing I love about your White Lion experience as well, is that it really reframes the role and the presence of the wild, that it's far more than what we understand it to be.
Like, absolutely.
There's prophecy and there's metaphor and there's signalling going on in the wild, like the birth of these cubs on mm-hmm. Christmas Day at the turn of the millennia, that signalling change and signalling healing. And that's what I love about the shamanic way, is this absolute love of the wild as an intelligent field of energy and love. And it is, isn't it? It's healing.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it extends through your lifetime, doesn't it? Some of those experiences, they're still weaving their way.
Yeah, I agree. I often talk about the pilgrimage trips that I do. Sadly, I haven't been able to do since COVID, but I'm ready to go as soon as the gates open. I'm out. Like, people say to me, "Where are you going to travel to first?" Like, I guess I should see my mum and dad, but you know what? I really want to go to the Amazon, or I really want to go to Africa. It's like after an experience like that, it's like you've downloaded sort of like a zip file, isn't it? And it just continues to unpack and unravel and reveal and guide you years after the initial visit. Yeah, I understand that. I do. Maggie, you and I really connected through your writing, Opus Onus, and also through our mutual friend Louise, who's my teacher and is a good friend of yours, I know. And it's your writing that really drew me to you. And I'd love to talk a bit about that, because what you do, and you're going to explain this better to me, but you collect story. You're like you're a storyteller, but you're also like a scribe, aren't you? Like, Opus Onus is sort of like capturing the story. So it's caught and it's within the collective consciousness. And I know a lot of people read your work, and I forwarded your work onto my community as well. So I guess my first question around Opus Onus is, what is your process for translating the non-ordinary into the language of the ordinary that we can then benefit from? Like, what do you actually do?
I see myself, firstly, again, there's always the prompt. So with the Opus Onus, there has to be that a deep call and a purpose that, again, wakes up my bones that would otherwise not do so. I have to forgo any comfort and casualness of what I already know.
Yep.
Then I start an archaeological dig. I start going into the depths. I start going into the heights. I create an openness.
Yeah.
And then I wait. I wait until I get a sense of little points of life emerging. You get that sensibility.
Yep.
Sort of smell, the animal smell. Over here, there's something here to investigate. And I will wait until I get some whisper that's there. Then I'll begin to make a mark on the paper, a very genesis stroke. It's like that beginning. Then I have to wait again until that starts to emerge, starts to fill itself out. I can grasp it a little further. So then it might comes. Be a word that's there.
Yeah.
Then there's the very much the task then as there's some notion is presented. My task then is to match a word to the truth.
Yeah.
Which is quite a laborious process. There's an integrity that has to be found.
Yeah.
So that matches not only the literal truth of the word being used, but it has to match that's trying to come forward through the mystery.
That's being expressed. It's true, yes, isn't it?
It also has to be, it has to present in a way that's almost alchemical. Yeah. So it has to be a doorway, a portal that people can actually go through to get into what is behind it. I certainly cannot bring it all forward. So it needs to be this doorways that hopefully people can move into something greater than the writings can ever present.
I think you totally achieve that. You totally do. I haven't read anything of yours where I haven't, it hasn't changed me.
Crane Leaving speaking.
I need a boyfriend.
Well, we have Señor Sombrero, Asakusa-san, or if you swing that way, Antoinette is available too. Check them out on crane-living.com and enjoy 10% off with Radio 10 when you cart out.
Oh, okay.
Terms and conditions apply. Don't get too excited. These are just names of our collections. We don't work that way. If you'd like to interact with real humans, come down to our flagship store at 46 Kim Yam Road.
This is where, I guess, going back to my original very sort of multi-layered question is the spiritual community. So that's another thing that you do, I think, with your writing is that you bring the story and the experiences of lots of people from around the world and you scribe them for us, you capture them for us. And so how do these people find you? So what's your – are these all people on your reading list and then – no? So
no.
That's spirit too, is it?
That's spirit too. Mostly unknown. It was through receiving them before I could actually publish it in Opus Onus. I then needed to link with each of those individuals as best I could to ask their permission.
Yeah.
I could post images, etc. So it was actually the reversal. This is the gathering of spirit. Somehow it
happens.
Starts to draw itself, that's right, towards an end. And then, of course, like you've said, afterwards there's this, here's Dani, you know, saying, will you do a podcast?
Yeah.
The others linking through the writings that are there. So it's a very large we.
Yeah, yeah. But it's fun.
Very large.
It's fun.
It's fun
too. Yeah.
Yes.
Because all you need to do is just turn up, really, don't you?
Sort of.
Sort of. Yeah. I'm a writer too, so I know what that's like.
Yes.
I love that term, the genesis stroke. It's gorgeous because that's exactly what it's like, isn't it? You need to pull something out of the dam and just get it trickling.
Yes.
And then it goes,
that's
yeah,
right.
The genesis stroke. That's a very cool term. Yeah. Oh, Maggie, we've got so many stories. I'd love to move to the Earth Treasure Vase project. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a project that I know you're very passionate about, that you've been very deeply involved with. It's a project that really has been happening for, you know, over 30 years. And I'll explain it, but I know you're going to explain it better. But it's basically a 30-year-strong spiritual community that's dedicated to honouring and reinvigorating the planet's songlines through generating a mandala of earth treasure vases that are blessed and buried in ritual at certain key nodes on the planet. And the process is completing, and you have held and blessed one of the treasure vases that was then planted into the earth. So could you tell us a little bit about this? Because I know that there would be people listening to this that have no idea that there are these groups of spiritual people that are so dedicated to healing the earth. And I also wonder, if there weren't these groups of spiritual people dedicated to healing the earth, where would we be today?
Indeed.
Because it's not awesome, is it? But it's not as bad as it could be. So
yes.
So tell us a bit about the Earth Treasure Vase project.
Okay. So a little on the background, it actually is a Tibetan practice or teaching. It began 1,000 years ago from the wise one back there, where they created these little clay vessels. They filled them with sacred blessings of many fold, and they buried in the earth. And it was said wherever they were buried, there was never war, famine, or disease. And it seems from Tibetan history back then that that was so.
Okay.
The teaching was actually drawn back into the inner world in the 8th century. And it was said it would reemerge again when humanity had the need. So it did reemerge in the 1800s, which was around the time of the Industrial Revolution.
Okay.
When man begins to impose itself upon nature.
Yep.
So they are little clay vessels. The story of 30 years is one of a beautiful woman called Cynthia Jurs from New Mexico. She's now a Tibetan Lama, a very different sort of wondrous Lama, woman Lama, a Buddhist practitioner of many years. Her teacher told her to go and visit his teacher, who happened to be the old wise man living in a cave in the high mountains of Nepal.
Yep.
106 years old.
Wow.
Like so a, off she went. Yeah.
It's like a story, isn't it? It's a
absolutely.
Yeah.
So when she had audience with him, her sole question was, what can we do to heal and protect the earth? He shook a finger at her and said, you need to take these earth treasure vases and bury them all around the world.
Wow.
Just put them in the ground and they know what to do. He also said that one person practicing in their local neighbourhood can change the world.
Beautiful.
So these vases, they're consecrated by all the lamas in the land. They are, the clay is filled with relics, with sacred substances that are quite mind-chilling. Mm. So sometime later, Cynthia received the shipment of these vases. They remained in her attic at home for about 5 years.
Yeah.
There was a level of preposterousness that planting a little vase in the earth could in any way solve the enormity of the problems of the earth until the earth itself began to call. Yeah. So for the last 30 years, Cynthia has overseen these earth treasure vases. They have been buried in extraordinary places, always linking with the indigenous people of the land, always with their permission and participation. And there was the initial 30, but then she was also gifted what we call the second generation of vases, a further 40. So there's been 70 vases in all. There's about 15 left on the altar, about another 11 who have custodians that are waiting to be buried.
Amazing. And so this is actually your experience with your earth treasure vase that you maintained on your altar until it was called to be buried. I was psychically connecting in with that. So I follow the Earth Treasure Vase project through their newsletters and things, and my teacher Louise, as you know, was involved within the group and the thinking for a while, and she invited me to shamanically journey and join the ceremony of burying one of the Earth Treasure Vases in the Australian outback. And I did that. I was in I may have been in Peru. I was somewhere, but I wasn't in Australia. But I went into journey and I participated in that ritual. I could see it. I could feel it. And when I reported back to Louise after that journey, I said, I saw them moving to a high place on a rock face. And there was a crevice in there. And I said, I saw a baby buried in there. I saw bones in there. And I think that's when Louise hooked us up. I think that's when she said, you need to talk to Maggie. So you ended up with that baby on your altar in your home space for some time. Can you tell us a bit more about that event?
The actual burial, et cetera?
Yeah, and also the baby. Yeah.
The link to the baby.
Yes.
So, yes, we were custodians of one of the vases that was buried in Pernalulu, Bungle, Western Australia. So we had it for about 2 to 3 years. It gets filled with prayers, blessings, offerings by as many as it possible. So indeed, the vision that you had, it was placed in a cave opening high on an escarpment. Julian, that yeah. you are also interviewing, he clambered up into the opening. Yeah. I was there against the rock face holding his feet. And we placed the vase in there. The vase are always then placed in a container. Yes. This was a beautiful box that had been made, so quite hefty, placed in there. The rest of the group were there and they were passing rocks to Julian to cover up the vase because the intention is they're never to be found again.
Yep.
But as we were doing this, Julian said, as soon as it was placed, the vase was no longer there.
So the earth?
The earth had just sucked it in.
Amazing.
This is a repeated experience with each of the burials.
Wow.
So the rocks were being passed, but Julian said there were none there.
It's gone.
But what was in the cave was a piece of hessian and some bones.
Yep.
And coming back after the ritual, Auntie Shirley was one of the Indigenous elders that had taken us there. She indeed said that a baby had been buried in that cave. But prior to that, even before we began the journey, we were in a motel room before we met up with the group over there. And I woke about 3 in the morning with a vision. And again, there was this young Aboriginal woman there holding a very, very tiny baby.
Mm-hmm.
And she was saying, you have to take this baby, which, of course, you know, no way.
Yeah.
But within it, I realised I needed to receive the baby.
Yeah.
So that was before the journey began even.
So you had that vision first and then went into ceremony and then the baby was found. And so when Auntie Margaret said, this is the baby is buried here, did you make that connection with the vision? Did you feel the awe?
Yes.
Because I can imagine that's a big move because I know most Indigenous law and especially Aboriginal law, you leave stuff where you find it, don't you? Like it's a big, but you were with the elders and you had their blessing. And so what happened then?
Also added to that, there were 2 people in the camp who had a visitation of a baby.
Wow.
Post the ceremony. And we had a little 7-year-old with us called Kangaroo Jack.
Yeah.
And I later found a drawing that he had made. This is prior to ceremony, prior to even arriving on the sacred land there. And it was quite clearly a drawing of a baby in a cave.
Oh, amazing. Okay.
No, on it goes.
On it goes. So good.
On it goes. That's right. That's right. Indeed. And then there's the extraordinary response of nature that also follows those events. Firstly, as we were coming down from that cave escarpment, Auntie Margaret was down at the bottom holding place and she wailed. She gave this extraordinary wail. It was like the story of 60,000 years of continuous living culture.
Wow.
A wail, it held the grief, the hope and the knowing And it was a wail that resounded into the country. It was the song of the ancient ones.
Oh, feeling it in my skin now.
It was extraordinary. Just honouring the birth of this dreaming. Auntie Margaret has said with these vases, we're creating a new dreaming story.
Yeah.
Then we go back to camp.
Yeah.
And apart from, you know, the guardians of the rock face as we're leaving, everything's standing up alive.
Yeah.
The Brolga that was completely part of the story, Brolga, a big heron bird. I don't know if that's Australian or not.
Yeah, it's Australian. Well, the term Brolga is, beautiful bird.
Big white heron-like bird who followed us all the way. She was there to point out where the placement site was.
Amazing.
As the ceremony finished, she flew off and took the story into the sky. Going back to the camp, one of the women who I actually call Brolga woman, she was there looking back into the distance towards where we had placed the vase, and over the site she saw this great shield of green light covering the placement site. And green Tara is an absolute ally of the Earth Treasure Vase practice.
Interesting.
That night around the campfire, we saw all these moving flashing lights in the sky. So everybody jumped up. I know, are they UFOs?
Yeah.
Who is it now? So we asked Auntie Shirley, who just laughed.
Yeah.
And she said, no, they're just spirit lights.
Yeah.
She said they were all over the camp last night.
Oh.
She went on to tell us that they're old ones and that there was a ridge just beside where we were camped. She said there are old ones, undomesticated ones, that live over there on that ridge, and they communicate with light. It's a bit like shining a mirror, but they don't have mirrors.
Wow.
This was the old ones in the camp.
Yeah.
Just before dawn the following morning, and this is our last day in camp, a dingo moved across the land from west to east, howling, sort of to awaken everybody. 14 howls it gave as it moved across the camp. With the last howl, it stopped and it became a pointer to the sky. And there in the sky was the Pleiades, seven sisters rising, which, you know, isn't always visible.
Yep.
Beside it was Venus and a crescent moon.
Beautiful.
Lasted for a very short moment before it was obscured by the cloud. So the dingo had drawn us.
Told you to. You know, this reciprocation, if that's the word, from nature is evident in all shamanic traditions. I had a huge conversation with this with Jorge Luis Delgado, who's in this series as well. He's Quechuan Peruvian shaman. And we experienced that in the mountains in Peru as well after ritual. There'd be, and also in Utah with the Lakota shaman, there's the wild will indicate the movement and also the acceptance of the offering. And it's and it never fails to blow your heart wide open, does it?
Absolutely.
It's just so beautiful to experience.
Yes.
And so what? Let's get back to the little baby.
Okay. Just finish that little bit there. Same time with the dingoes, the Brolga was there again.
Yeah.
It made this ruckus noise as it flew off into the paddock, and also affirming what you've just said in the final sharing with Auntie Bessie and Auntie Shirley. They said that earlier they'd thought that nobody cared about them.
Yeah.
But through this process that we'd brought the spirit to the country and that the dingoes and the Brolgas that were now flying off were saying goodbye.
Yeah.
The country was happy. And that Brolga left a huge, large white feather for Brolga women.
Beautiful. Yeah,
it's so completing, Dani. It gives you such strength, but it is such an affirmation.
Yeah, it's just it's blissful. Mm. Yeah. Okay, so the little one. So how on earth did you receive this little one back into your life and into your home?
So it's your meaning on the altar.
Yeah, and
right,
and also what were the what
just did, symbolism?
What did the elders? What was the guidance around taking the baby? I mean, you had the visioning, obviously, and there were shared visions within the camp. Yes.
So it wasn't literally taking the baby. Yep. We did, from the cave itself, with Auntie Shirley's permission, we did take a handful.
Yep.
That goes into, is what we call the cave bundle on the altar.
Yep.
But with each of the vases, there's a little bit that's taken that goes into every other vase.
Ah.
So every vase has sand from under the paws of the white lions.
Yep.
It has water from the Amazon. It has fur from the polar bear in Alaska.
Wow.
So there's a little tincture that goes into every subsequent vase that's there. So that's partly its purpose.
Okay.
Certainly, look, we have a ritual here each month, an earth treasure vase with a small group of beautiful women. We do pass around the bundle.
Yeah.
And it certainly, you could call it a baby. It has a pulse sometimes. You can literally feel it.
Amazing.
Feel a heartbeat that's there. Sometimes you hold it and it's light as a feather. Other times your arms drop to the ground. It's so heavy.
Wow.
Sometimes it has story. Sometimes it's silent. It's certainly some of that profundity of country. Of song lines that it holds. There's a giving and a receiving, hopefully, that is there.
So it's
The birthing, I think, is such a big, I mean,
yep.
Yes, we speak a long time of the birth of the new baby.
Yeah.
That's seeking to emerge.
Just incredible, Maggie. Well, I look very reticently, I'm going to have to wrap this up, but we're definitely doing at least one other one. I think we've got enough stories in you to do about 20. But I wanted to end with just one more question for you, and that is for people who might be listening to this who are stirred, you know, by story and perhaps feeling an ache to connect in with some of the things that we've been talking about, you know, with the wilderness, with a much more embodied feeling of spirit and being alive and the things and the healing that's available through the shamanic path, but we're unable to travel. We're going to link them to your writing. But what are, so for example, three simple things that someone can do or start doing in their life which will be the genesis stroke of their journey opening up? What would you say to people?
I would certainly cast an invitation, and I know you'll have the link as well, to join in the Earth Treasure Vase global community.
Yep.
There's a Zoom call every full moon. It's a wonderful world community. It also is working with each of the earth treasure vases, both those that are buried as well, working with this mandala, this yep. network of love, of light, of all that is that's there. It's very easy. It's very accessible. You can sit in the background and not say a word,
yep.
just absorb. You can also get it on recording.
Yep.
So I think, you know, the key to these emerging times is the we.
Yeah, yeah.
It is about community.
Yeah.
It is about a we. I would also pass the baton to everyone. You know, some of these stories are very particular to me, but I think everybody has the shamanic bone and blood.
Yep.
You know, can be is if it is the meeting of heaven and earth, spirit and matter, then that can be sitting in the garden.
Yep.
And just being in wonder.
Beautiful.
You know, to nature out there. You can be like my dear partner Ava, who goes to the supermarket and will start singing a song in the middle of the supermarket. You know?
Yeah.
And everybody gathers around. People turn into smiles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there. But also I think a level of, I think these times are calling for a courageous
yep.
movement. that we all have to take. I mean, I would never have dreamt of years ago that I would be sitting here speaking with you. No, the terror of speaking out was unmanageable at that stage. So I think we all have boundaries at the moment to move out, and the deepest resource is Mother Nature.
Yep, agreed.
And community, a level of we, however you find it, can be we, can be you and the pussycat.
Yep.
It can be, even if you can be living on your own and still be an expression of we and community. And just knowing the power of your prayer and your blessing.
Absolutely.
Everything is heard.
Yep.
Everything goes somewhere. Everything creates something.
Yep. And we're essential to it as well. I think we're not separate from it. We're essential to it.
Yes, absolutely.
Maggie Wisson, what a delight. Thank you so much for your time. And we will be putting all of those links with the podcast. And stand by. I'm going to be calling you again. Thank you so much, Maggie.
Thank you, Dani. Thank you for the invitation and the developmental process that went with it.
It's my pleasure. I'm pleased. I'm pleased you were courageous.
Wonderful.
Thanks, Maggie. Bye.
Thank you, Dani.